This is God and Autobiography, the podcast, a dramatic adaptation of the book God and Autobiography as Told to a Philosopher by Jerry L. Martin. He was a lifelong agnostic, but one day he had an occasion to pray. To his vast surprise, God answered in words. Being a philosopher, he had a lot of questions, and God had a lot to tell him. Episode 27. A series of dramatic visions had been given to Zoroaster, a priest of the old religion. There were visions of two gods in conflict. One was the Lord Wisdom, who created the world. The other was the hostile spirit, who, in envy and spite, roused Devas, demons, to attack it. The Lord Wisdom knew what the outcome would be. The hostile spirit did not. Nevertheless, the Lord Wisdom generously offered peace. Evil spirit, aid my creatures and give praise, so that in recompense for that you may be immortal. To which the hostile spirit snarled, I shall not aid your creatures, and I shall not give praise, but shall destroy you and your creatures forever and ever, and I shall persuade all your creatures to hate you and to love me. The Lord Wisdom knew that a battle would have to be fought. Otherwise, the hostile spirit would make perpetual strife. He will be able to lead my creatures astray and make them his own. Once the evil spirit determined to fight, the Lord Wisdom revealed the final outcome. His own final victory and the powerlessness of the evil spirit and the destruction of the devils, and also the resurrection of the future body, and the freedom of creation from the assault forever and ever. Lord, it led also to the idea of a final judgment, and hence of reward and punishment.
All inapt judgment occurs at every moment, and it is internal to the situation, not external. In other words, if one does wrong, one by that fact suffers wrongness. And it does not have to be pronounced by a divine judge then or later. And it has its penalty intrinsic to it. It is crummy to be a bad person.
This is puzzling, Lord. People want to be bad people? They want to be crummy?
The trick of evil is to convince the person, or for the person to convince themselves, that they can do this bad thing without becoming bad. Like an alcoholic who thinks they can have just one drink, or that a little cheating is okay, or that since everybody takes bribes, that's just how business is done here.
The Zoroaster scholar Mary Boyce says the holy immortals, divine helpers such as Good Purpose, were brought into existence for this one end, namely the utter defeat of evil?
No, that is incorrect, even on its face. Good Purpose is not just about battling evil. It is about telos, direction, fulfillment, development. There is more to life and to the universe than just battling evil. Victory over evil in particular circumstances is the precondition of other fulfillments, but they have their own telos and role in the scheme of things. Love, beauty, and so forth are positive goods and actualized creation. They would still need to be done to be pursued even if there were no evil.
The ancient Pahlavi version has a fascinating twist on the creation myth. First, the Lord Wisdom brought things into being in a disembodied state, called in Pahlavi Menog, that is, spiritual or immaterial. Then he gave them material, or getig, existence. This gives things substantial and sentient form. It is the second step, Boyce explains, that sets the field for the battle with evil, since the world is now vulnerable to assault. Is this right, Lord? In the ideal world, things are safe. Once they become real, they are vulnerable?
You might say that the idea or potential for all things resides beforehand or in another dimension. In that mode or dimension, evil cannot strike. There is no evil, but there is no goodness, no beauty, no virtues either.
I see. Before creation, there is no fight with evil, but afterwards there is. Is that right, Lord?
Now, the main point of the contrast is not to focus on how things existed before material creation, but how they exist in this world, and for what purpose. As you sense, there is a big story here. The sheer need for friction, for grit, for traction, for obstacles for spirit to grow and develop, but also to fulfill goods that cannot be fulfilled only in the mind's eye. Why does the artist, who may have already envisioned the final result, have to make it immaterial? Why does the composer have to have an imperfect orchestra actually play the perfect symphony he hears in his head? Why does the mathematician want to write down his equations? There is a deep truth here about the nature of reality. Reality wants to be embodied. In this respect, philosophical traditions that derive from Plato get it wrong. The material object does not fall beneath the perfect form. It actualizes it. The form may be perfect, but like Kant's imaginary $100, it doesn't exist. Or if you want to say it exists in some sense, it doesn't exist in the sense that counts. It is not in the world. It is not instantiated. It has no instances. It should not be hard to understand that.
Well, I think I get it. What counts is what happened in the real material world.
There is a deeper meaning here that relates to why there is suffering. To be fully real, a thing has to exist in material form. We're not talking about materialism versus spiritual reality in this context, but simply existence in this world. Material existence does subject it to limitations. Hence the sense of a fall from grace, limitations which include erosion, destruction, and in more complex forms, disease, dysfunction, and in human beings, death, suffering, and evil. This may or may not be the best of all possible worlds, as Leibniz thought, but any possible world, that is, any world that can be actual, must have death, suffering, and evil. Those are conditions of its being real.
Any possible world? Couldn't God just create a different kind of world?
Do not get off into ideas like the omnipotence of God. Those are inventions, logical devices that confuse rather than clarify. They are simply not apt. In other words, it is not helpful to say either that God is omnipotent, or that God's power is limited. Those contrasts do not apply meaningfully in this context.
According to the Zoroastrian scriptures, the creation of the world occurs during the course of a sacrifice that the Lord Wisdom is conducting. During the sacrifice, he actually consults with human beings, or more precisely, their fravars, their inner selves or souls. First, he gives them the wisdom of all knowledge, and then he lets them decide. They can either stay in their ideal non-material existence until the battle is over, or they can go into the material world now, risking all in order to defeat evil. They choose to fight.
Yes, this world, this plane of existence, is a battleground. That is not all it is. Do not make the mistake of reducing all human life to one long moral struggle. That is a feature of all existence, but it is not the totality of it.
What is the rest?
Well, that is too long to recount, but start with love. The world is also pervaded by love, from the physical level on up. It is pervaded by beauty, by rational order, by purpose, by many other things. Evil attacks these things, but it is not going to win.
Lord, I'm not seeing how your story develops.
Let me tell you how it is from my side. All these things are happening simultaneously. The Chinese are casting oracle bones, and I'm communicating with them. At the same time, I'm instilling in those who are receptive the truth of heaven, of their membership in a cosmos, an ordered natural reality.
With which they must be in tune.
Yes. At the same time, I am presenting a very different vision to Zoroaster. I am revealing the two sides of my nature, presented as two forces contending. This is not as evil as it sounds. The negative side is mainly the side of incompleteness that motivates the whole story. The Old Testament story is, in a sense, an answer to Zoroaster. It brings out the developmental side. The Old Testament narrative is the story of my development.
So you are developing through all this?
Yes, good question. What is the impact of all this on my development? Isn't it clear? Relating to people harmoniously in my presence to the Chinese actualizes the harmonious in me. I satisfy the recognized order like being an aesthetic object that has to be seen by a sensitive observer to come into its own. The revelation to Zoroaster is a self-disclosure that involves a self-discovery. I articulate much more clearly my own divided nature, the orderly part and the disorderly part. And that points the way to overcoming it.
I had thought the idea of a divided or incomplete God was alien to the Judeo-Christian tradition until I read Jewish scholar John Levinson's book, Creation and the Persistence of Evil. It is a striking account of a central theme in the Hebrew Testament that one does not readily notice, the ongoing struggle for order to triumph over chaos. Chaos is symbolized by images related to water, oceans, floods, and sea monsters, such as Leviathan. The opening of Genesis, in which the waters are separated from the earth, is an essential step in the creation of divine order. Levinson explains that God's task is the confinement of chaos, not its elimination. Chaos, symbolized by unruly waters, remains a constant threat, and the survival of ordered reality hangs only upon God's vigilance in ensuring that those cosmic dikes do not fail. That vigilance is assured by God's covenant with humankind in Genesis 9, never to flood the world again. In fact, it was not so much God who decided to flood the world as it was evil that opened the dikes.
Yes.
The world, Levinson explains, is inherently unsafe. Creation endures because God has pledged in an eternal covenant that it shall endure, and because he has, also in an eternal covenant, compelled the obeisance of the great adversary. Thus, the world contains an ancient and enduring opposition to the full realization of God's mastery, which is destined to be eliminated in the end. There is, Levinson says, both an optimistic element in this theology, which is the faith in God's ultimate triumph, and a pessimistic element, which is the tacit acknowledgement that God is not yet God. This was just what I had been told. God develops, comes into his fullness as God, only over time and only through interaction with human beings and other elements of creation. Our cup of salvation will indeed run over, but it is now only half full and half empty, explains Levinson. Life is a continual war against the evil impulse, a war that does not see a definitive victory in present reality, but in which battles can be won. The evil impulse, the unruly, erotic, darker, aggressive side of our nature, is an innate impediment to reality as God, the potentially omnipotent, wishes it to be. Lord, in one midrash, a rabbinic elaboration on the Bible, the projection of the evil impulse goes as far as the inner being of God himself.
Yes.
This is a theology with absolute faith in God's ultimate goodness, Levinson says, but a rather qualified faith in his proximate goodness. Nevertheless, that ultimate triumph of God's goodness is in some ways present today. The partial present availability of final eschatological reality is,
yes,
is a conviction characteristic of many communities in the spectrum of ancient Judaic culture, Qumranian, rabbinic, early Christian, and perhaps others. Lord, according to Levinson, it is in moments of obedience to God's commandments that the ultimately real becomes available in the present order.
Yes.
Levinson concludes, it is in those elusive but ever available moments that the deeply flawed present is forced to yield to the perfect future. And it is in this idea of a multi-leveled act of unification, unification in God, in creation, and in the human self, that we find the deep root of the profound theology of the mitzvah, good deed, as an activation of the divine, which flowers a millennium later in Spanish Kabbalah. It is the mitzvah that effects integrity throughout all tiers of reality and enables the life-enhancing divine energy to flow freely and without inhibitions. Then, Lord, human effort completes creation, understood as God's order and sovereignty?
Yes.
I had come across a similar idea about mitzvot, the plural of mitzvah, in The 13-Petaled Rose by Aidan Steinsalt, the greatest living Kabbalist. When I prayed about it, I was told,
mitzvot are central. They construct the world.
Lord, is it true that a mitzvah is a spiritual act? Sacred in itself?
Yes, they are sacred points of God shining through.
So the Old Testament can be seen as a response to Zoroaster's vision of twin gods, one good and one evil. Instead, it presents one God who is contending against evil, including his own incompleteness, and defeating it with our help, not only in the end time, but at sacred moments right now. Zoroaster was just one offshoot of the old religion. The other was carried by invaders across the Khyber Pass into India. Thank you for listening to God and Autobiography, the podcast. The words of God are spoken by Jerry L. Martin, who heard the voice. He can be reached at godandautobiography.com. The narration and dialogue of Mr. Martin are spoken by Scott Langdon, who also edited, mixed, and engineered this episode. He can be reached at thescottlangdon.com. You can read the original true story in the book from which this podcast was adapted, God and Autobiography as Told to a Philosopher by Jerry L. Martin. Available now at Amazon.com and always at godandautobiography.com. Pick up your own copy today.